Okay, good evening. Happy Erev Chanukah.
Thank you.
Getting there. I want to thank Farley and Jessica, Jessica and Farley, for opening their new home to us right away. Home should always be open for Torah gatherings, and for simchas and for good things.
Amen.
Thank you to Alana. Is Alana here? Alana again for organizing this, and appreciate it. Okay, so I want to begin by picking up where we last left off. Last time, we were talking about Zeya, the concept of steam. If you remember the pressing question that emerged,
steam.
When you heat water and it turns into steam, we said the steam has the same status as the liquid that produced the steam. So if you heat chicken soup and it produces chicken soup steam, the steam itself is fleshik. It has the impact, and that's the way ovens are affected. Ovens absorb the steam of milk, and ovens absorb the steam of dairy. And therefore, we delineated three appropriate ways to use one oven for both meat and dairy. If you don't have the luxury of two ovens, or one of your ovens breaks, or it's Shavuos and you have a Yontif, whatever the case may be. So how do you use one oven for meat and dairy? We talked about three possibilities. One is that you kasher it in between. The second is that you cover everything. Or the third is that you designate it for either meat and dairy, and you cover the alternative. How does covering it help? Because steam is the conduit through which taste is going to be exchanged. So as we talked about steam, and I talked about the steam hits the hood, under the oven, the spices. So the question came up about the hot water urn. The hot water urn, if you're releasing water into something that's going to produce steam, maybe that impacts the status of the plastic thing.
Spout.
We'll go with spout. That works. The spout of the hot water urn. So for example, the halacha is, we'll get into this tonight with Shabbos, the halacha is that if your chalent is drying out, you're allowed to take out, you're probably obligated, to take out the chalent from the insert of your crock pot or the pot, and you're allowed to add hot water from another primary source, like a hot water urn. So if you check on your chalent on Friday night, which by the way, you shouldn't lift the lid while it's still in the urn, we'll talk about that in the crock pot, we'll talk about that in a moment. But if you check on your chalent and you find it to be dry, you're allowed to add hot water. So he said, but when you take the lid off, the steam is pouring off your chalent. You're going to hold it underneath the urn, that steam is going to hit the spout of your urn. Is your spout now fleshic? So that the next morning when you want to make your cup of coffee that you're going to have with milk, are you stuck? That was the question you asked me last time. And I was stuck. So I spoke to Rabbi Rabinovicki. And Rabbi Rabinovicki said he had this exact question 30 years ago. Of course, only when you have his memory. And he spoke to a specific posek, and he told me that it's not a problem for the following reason. When steam, he says, is in a open area, it doesn't have that impact to impart or transfer the taste. So when you're talking about steam in a confined area like an oven, so there you talk about steam being effective. You talk about steam underneath a hood, the steam is collected, it's effective, it's potent. But if steam is in just an open area, you're holding a chalent pot underneath the urn, but the steam is going everywhere, it doesn't have the impact, and it's not a problem using the same spout and the same hot water urn. So that was the answer to that question. And I see we've already generated enough questions that we're not going to get to Shabbos. Yeah.
So that's the same thing with the milk and coffee that is open. It's not like if you put...
Yes, yes.
So it's not like it's the spices as well?
So the spices... Spices, the issue is the steam is getting into the enclosed area of the, you know, and what made it very compelling is when some of you shared last time that when the steam enters the spices, it often clumps it up, right? Yes. Which is empirical evidence that the steam is getting into the spice bottle. So again, if you can, I think you should try to remember to put the spice in your hand and then in the, or hold the spices far away enough, or if you want to be really strict, I know families that have meat and dairy ketchup bottles. Particularly if you have young kids at home, you know that the top of the ketchup makes contact with lots of hot foods. The hot macaroni and cheese, and then the next day the hot chicken and the hot french fries from the filet chicken. So, you know, again, are there leniencies you can rely on in these cases? Likely. If you're setting up a proper practice, is it best to not put the spices directly? Yeah, that would be the best practice. Okay, so anything else? I hesitate to ask this, but with the kosher kitchen... Before we get into Shabbos a little bit, yes.
Since the last class we had, I haven't been using my kettle for coffee.
Right.
So gathering from what you're saying right now, I can go back to
it. Back in play. Kettle's back in play. No problem. We have redeemed the kettle. Okay, anything else? There were hands that went up before. Anything else from... Yes.
Sorry, no problem. Just happened this morning.
Sure.
I want to think it was full of
dairy dishes.
Right.
Dairy food stuck to it. My daughter was being helpful and took two bowls of beef stew. There's still some stew in it. And threw them in the sink.
Everything was cold?
It's all cold, but how do I
wash it all off?
With cold water?
Cold it with wash. Cold water, just rinse it all off till it's all clean and everything's okay.
All fine.
All fine. All right, so remember from the last time that for heat, for taste to transfer, you need the medium of either heat, or you need pickling, or you need duchke de sakina, the sharpness of a knife. So in that case, in the sink, everything was cold, and therefore it's okay. Okay, anything? Yes. No problem.
I was cooking something in a meat pan that hadn't been used at least in a day.
Okay.
And it was, so I was sauteing onions. They were not hot yet, but I took a par of spoon to mix it. But like, it's, I mean, it's electric, so it didn't get hot yet.
In other words, you could have touched the onions. They weren't hot
for
enough.
Sure, yeah.
So then just rinse it off. It's fine. Not a problem. Okay.
What was the problem with it's a par?
No, it would become fleshy because the onion was cut with a fleshy knife.
I was sauteing the hot.
And right, right. But it wasn't yet hot. So, in other words, a cold onion that was cut with a meat knife, if that cold onion made contact with a dairy utensil, it wouldn't affect the utensil. So the equivalent here wasn't hot yet. Or par, if I'm saying, but even dairy, it wouldn't affect.
The onion was like cut, like before it went into the pot, it was totally par. Like,
right, right. No, I understand. But still, it's because it was not yet hot. It's okay. Yes. Dairy pots and the meat cupboard.
So obviously I'm using the meat cupboard. So now I'm going to go buy new dairy pots.
You could kasher them. No, that won't. Mikvah is something different. You could kasher a pot one of two ways. I don't know that it will make it through. You could kasher a pot by inserting it into boiling water in a bigger pot. But a lot of the pots are so big that it's hard to find a bigger pot. Small ones? So boil water in a... Take a pot, don't use it for 24 hours, boil water till it's mala ababulos, it's really overflowing, bubbling, and then dip the smaller pots into it. And you've kashered it.
What if it's too big?
What if it's what?
Too big.
If the pot is too big, it's a messy thing, but then you fill it with water and heat it as much as you can. You take a stone and you heat it, like on the stove, and you drop it into the pot, it'll make the water rush over the sides, and that will kasher it. And make a big mess. Just be very careful, wear gloves, and so on. The only thing I would say to you, Rhonda, is be careful, because if they were dairy and you've gotten used to using them as meat, you might be confused in their designation, so you might be better off telling Jeff that you have to buy new pots. Yeah.
But that can only be done on a stainless steel or an aluminum pot.
Correct. In other words, it has to be a pot which is eligible for kashering, made of a material eligible for kashering. Stainless steel, hard plastic, but... something from the glass, coral, clay, whatever, all those materials can't be kashered. Yeah?
No, I just want to know the handles, the plastic handles.
Plastic handles are okay, they can be kashered also.
They can go in boiling water?
Yeah. In other words, if you see that there's a space between, if the screws are loose on the plastic handles, food could have gotten in there, then you should take them apart, clean them, and maybe kasher them separately. But if everything is one unit and clean, they can be kashered together.
Onion, that's onion?
Yes.
Hot onion cut with a par knife in a fleshed pan should not be served with a par spoon?
Correct. The fleshed pan with the onion are going to impart fleshed into whatever. Yes.
Can I work with fruit? So it was okay to buy...
Cut up fruit. Mm-hmm.
So why are we going to Winn-Dixie and buying the one that has a...
Because you want to support the Winn-Dixie Corporation. You don't need to.
Why do they sell it?
Because when
it's not more expensive?
I went to Publix.
Oh, yes, please.
It is. So then the day I went.
Well, at Publix, it wasn't more.
I bought at Publix. It was like $7 for the same size that Winn-Dixie has for $7.
Right.
They remember it's not like... Okay.
Yeah. It's not necessary. There's a lot of... I mean, water also doesn't need a hechsher, but the OU makes a lot of money by putting it on water, so... And as there's a mashgiach there, they're watching the guy cut, they throw it on, it helps marketing, it makes people believe. Until 2 weeks ago, you all thought you needed to buy that one, so...
It's the same thing, right? On the same shelf.
Right. It's not a problem. Correct. If you find yourself in the middle of nowhere, buy fruits and vegetables, no problem. Yes?
I was looking, I was purchasing takes the salad. I thought it said ORB, but it said ORC. It's ORC.
Yeah, that's also okay. You all know better than I do. What do we say? ORC? COR. Which one is this? This one? ORV? OR.
CORC is with Canada.
The best, let me tell you, people text me all the time. Right, as I was going to say, people text me all the time questions about symbols, and I'll tell you what I do, not because I'm trying to save myself time, but because it just makes life easier. If you have an iPhone or an Android, if you have a smartphone, but download the CRC app. And the CRC app, it's fantastic. If you don't have either, just go on the internet and print out the list for yourselves. CRC. CRCkosher.org is their website, and there's an app. Just look in the app store for CRC. And the CRC app has, it has unbelievable lists. It has a beverage list. So you want to know, you're taking your kids Slurpees at 7-Eleven, and which Slurpees are okay? It's got the list. If you, yeah. They don't have a Starbucks list. Nobody has a Starbucks list because no one wants to touch that. But they have... Don't answer about Starbucks. But they have a fruit and vegetable list in terms of what needs to be checked, how checked. I was in the supermarket the other night with my kids and someone stopped me to ask me about frozen vegetables. And I just opened the CRC app. And I looked it up and whatever the vegetable was, I gave the answer. It's all... CRC is, the to me, the most moderate, balanced, reasonable, but very wonderful standards based on Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz and the Poskim of the CRC. It's fantastic. So they have beverage lists, they have fruit and vegetables, they have shopping lists, they have all kinds of lists. Yes?
I'm from Brazil, so in Brazil, the factories are not allowed to put symbols.
Right.
So, but the Kaban has a list.
Right. From Brazil?
Yes.
Yeah, if Chabad told you that they're good enough, they did the research, yeah. A lot of European countries are like that, where they don't put the Hechsher, you got to go buy the private list from someone and then you're, and you work off of that. Okay, should we move over to Shabbos? Anything else with General Kashrus? Okay. Where should we focus on Shabbos? Alana, you're the chairwoman of this group. What would you like to focus on? About...
I received a couple of questions about ovens.
Ovens. You've supported me, the ovens, yeah. And the warming drawers. So why don't we start with that?
Talk about the fish and the meat also at some point. Cooking
come back to fish and meat. Okay, we'll come back to the fish and meat and barbecues. Let's go to the world of Shabbos for a minute. So I want to do the same thing that I did last time, which is introduce our discussion of Shabbos by reminding everybody why we have these details and minutiae and rules of Shabbos. We spoke about this on Shabbos Shuvah 2 or 3 years ago. All about the philosophy and the values of Shabbos. Shabbos is not supposed to enslave, it's supposed to liberate. The whole idea of Shabbos is that once a week, we are free. We think, unfortunately many of our children think, that Shabbos enslaves us and the rest of the week we're free, but it's really the opposite. The whole week long we are enslaved to our technology, we're enslaved to our job, we're enslaved to our social pressures, we're enslaved to where there must be this and there must see that and there must do that and the chore list that we have to get to, and we're enslaved. And Shabbos is the great liberator. If you remember from up north, the greatness of a snow day was that no matter how many things you had to do, you had no guilty feeling in the fact that you weren't doing any of them. Mm-hmm. Right? You just you couldn't do it. It wasn't up to you. So Shabbos is a guilt-free, disconnected day of being liberated from the world. You're disconnected from technology, the laundry and the cooking and the shopping and the planning and the working and the emails and the phone calls and the... You just can't do any of it. So it's incredibly liberating, and that's Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. The way it commemorates Yetzias Mitzrayim is, just like we were liberated, so too on Shabbos we are liberated. Just as leaving Egypt meant our time became our own, and we weren't enslaved to a master, so too on Shabbos our time becomes our own. All week long we're enslaved to whatever that schedule on our phone tells us we have to do, to whatever the obligations are, to wherever we have to be. Shabbos, you know, obviously we have certain responsibilities, but we are able to allocate the time the way we want. So Shabbos is supposed to liberate us and uplift us. Shabbos is about returning to our roots. Shabbos, Lashuv, it's about returning. Tshuva and Shabbos go together. That's what we spoke about, that Shabbos Shuvah at length. So Shabbos is a rejuvenating, once a week experience of disconnecting from the world and reconnecting to what matters. Our families, our own thoughts, our own spiritual ambition and aspiration, reading a book. Who reads books anymore other than Orthodox Jews on Shabbos? Right? Who can live 24 hours without touching technology? I like to say that soon enough, the Orthodox Jewish community will become such an... Us and the Amish, we and the Amish will be unbelievable anomalies. They'll put us in a museum to look at. Right? Can you imagine? Is there anyone you know who's not Shabbos observant who can go an hour, let alone 25 hours, without checking email, text messages, their phone, going on the internet, watching TV? Right? We are becoming dinosaurs in that sense, and we are proudly doing so because we will be the last sane group if we realize that we should embrace this gift instead of bemoaning it, and teach our kids how excited we are to do it, how excited we are to disconnect and put it away and be liberated. Who plays board games with their families anymore? Who reads books? Who has endless Shabbos meals, right? If not us, right? Because we have Shabbos. Without Shabbos, who would be doing any of those things? So Shabbos is supposed to be an incredible gift in order to pursue and to do all of those things. Why am I giving that as the introduction? Because again, if you get lost in the minutiae and the details, like how do I eat, what do I do, what if I play, then again, Shabbos becomes, you know, first I got myself into trouble once, but I might as well do it again. The preparation for Shabbos is not supposed to be enslaving, right? If Shabbos is supposed to be liberating, preparing for Shabbos should not be a burden that exhausts you beginning from Monday, Tuesday. I'm going to come up with my menus and my recipes and my shopping, and I have to start cooking Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, and the last minute is Friday, and then I have to be able to serve it on 17 layers of fancy things and 14 courses with 15 side dishes, and everything is tricolored and everything is whatever, right? I wrote about that. I had to apologize to everybody afterwards. And I will make this very clear. If anyone enjoys doing that, do it. If anyone enjoys it, they should do it. Enjoy it. If you love it, do it, and there's nothing wrong with it. And if it's your hobby, love it, do it, enjoy it, bask in it, but we can't pressure other people to do it. So when we create a culture where there's competition and where it's expensive to keep up and where it makes a lot of unhealthy families because we're all overeating, it's not what Shabbos is all about. The food is supposed to be delicious and fantastic, but incidental to the conversation and the people and the company and the experience. So you don't need... I went away with Yocheved for Shabbos last year at one point. And we just went to Kosher Market on our way, and we picked up, we ate nothing, right? The Shabbos meal was like, you washed and you had whatever we bought, whatever. And then there was like the piece of chicken with the one piece of kugel, and then we brought something for dessert. And afterward, and we talked and we enjoyed, we had an incredible Shabbos. I said, did you miss like all the other things? Like, it was the best Shabbos ever, and it didn't have 17 side dishes or whatever. Sometimes you have to go back to the basics to remember how that it's not supposed to, right? So you're never at the table because you're constantly preparing the next 14 courses and putting everything out. And by the time you get to the table, everyone's done eating and they just want to bench. And that's not what Shabbos is. So we've got to, it's up to you, not I say we, but it's up to you. We have to create a culture that the people who enjoy it, do it, love it, it's fantastic. But that we don't create an expectation and a pressure on others to make it happen. So that's just an introduction, a reminder that Shabbos is supposed to be liberating and uplifting and inspiring, and not all that detracts from those things. So the laws of Shabbos come along in order to enforce that, and we shouldn't get lost in the minutiae and details in a way which actually compromises our enjoyment of Shabbos. Okay, so there are 39 malachas of Shabbos, the 39 categories of forbidden labor. Labor is a misnomer. Labor is not what's forbidden on Shabbos. If labor were forbidden on Shabbos, you could not live in Boca in August and go to shul. Because walking the shul is a much greater labor than turning on the light or than driving in a car. So obviously it's not labor that's forbidden on Shabbos. What's forbidden on Shabbos? So the Torah calls what's forbidden malachas machshev, it's creative labor. Creative labor is very different. Labor means physical labor. Creative labor, malachas machshev, means human ingenuity. That's what's forbidden on Shabbos. Why is that what's forbidden on Shabbos? What does the Kodesh Baruch Hu want from us out of Shabbos? He wants us to return to our roots. Right? Go back to Bereshis. Man is created, Kodesh Baruch Hu puts him in the world and says, Pru urvu meluas haaretz, go, multiply and fill the world, vikiv shuha, conquer the world. Study physics, biology, chemistry, engineering, technology, go conquer the world. Go manipulate nature. Right? And we are living through a technological revolution that we are manipulating nature left and right. We are making the world do what we want it to do. And we're learning how to do that more and more and more every single day. Build an artificial that, and control that, and predict this, and make that happen. Kosh Baruch Hu said, Kivshuha. I don't want to repeat that whole Shabbos Shuvah drasha, but if you remember, in Jewish philosophy, work is not just because it's a necessary evil of life. Work is a value. Kadosh Baruch Hu said, I work to create the world, you imitate me by working, so that you can experience the opposite of work, which is rest. Kadosh Baruch Hu rested. What does that mean, he rested? God did not break a sweat when he built the world. He did not need to break a sweat. What it means for Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Ribono Shel Olam, to rest means he ceased to create. He was at rest, meant to be at peace with all that he had created. And that's the same thing he says to us. Stop creating, take a deep breath, and be at peace with what already has been created. Be at peace with nature. Stop manipulating it, controlling it, stop designing it, stop discovering it, innovating it. Just be at peace for 24 hours with nature. So how are you at peace with nature? By asering, by prohibiting malachas machshavos. In other words, stop manipulating nature, creative labor. If you look at all 39 malachas, with the exception maybe of one, they are all expressions of creative labor. Meaning, how do you define creative labor? Something a monkey's not going to do. The first 11 categories of the 39 malachas are called sidur de pas. They are all part of the process of how do you make bread. 11 steps to making bread. From plowing and planting, even though it appears the opposite, which the Gemara then asks, Zoreya then Choresh, but you plow, then you plant, then you harvest, then you winnow, then you grind, then you sift, then you mix the dough, and then you bake, and then you... I missed a few of the steps, but there's a lot of steps. All those steps have in common is that if man never invented bread, a monkey would not have. The monkey would never have discovered how to plant wheat, and how to grow wheat, and how to harvest wheat, and how to grind it, and winnow it, and sift it, and grind it, and mix it, and it wouldn't have. It's human ingenuity, it's human creativity that discovered bread. That's why throughout Tehillim and throughout Tanakh, bread is so synonymous as the staple of the human being, not just because bread is the staple of every meal, but bread is the symbol of human ingenuity. Right? There's fruits and vegetables that grow from the ground, that's a gift from Hashem. Bread is the symbol of where it takes the human being to manipulate. So all 39 categories, the one exception maybe is carrying, from the public domain to the private domain. A monkey could carry things. So why is that one of the malachas? Why is that malachas machsheves? The Eglei Tal, the Sochet Shev Rebbe asked that question. It's a whole discussion. But the 39 categories, for the most part, are all creative labors. That's what Hashem says stop doing. Walk to shul on Shabbos in August in Boca, you're going to schwitz? That's not a creative labor. A monkey could do that, you could do that. But flip on a light switch. By flipping a switch, make light glow? No monkey could ever discover light. That's human. That's uniquely human. So don't do that. Be at peace with nature. Now, be at peace with nature doesn't mean to sit in the dark. The Tzedukim thought that. Because the Pasuk describes that losavaru esh b'chol moshav aseichem, you're not allowed to burn a fire in all your dwelling places. So the Tzedukim said, what does it mean to be at peace with nature? Means literally at nature. As if you haven't manipulated it at all. Sit in the dark and the cold, and that's all you have. We accept the oral Torah. We accept Torah Shabbat Peh, which says, no. Losavaru esh b'chol moshav aseichem means you can't light a new fire on Shabbos. But to benefit from a fire from before Shabbos? Absolutely. That's why we turn lights on before Shabbos. That's why we cook. This is the origin of the mitzvah to eat shalot. That's not a joke. There's actually a mitzvah, the Mishnah Berurah quotes based on the Shulchan Aruch, there's a mitzvah to eat hot food. Notice that Jews, wherever we migrated in the world, whether the Sephardim or the Ashkenazim or the four corners of the globe, all have, whether it's shalot or chamin or different permutations of a hot food which was put up before Shabbos and which you eat on Shabbos day. Why is that? It's an affirmation that we believe in the Torah Shabbat Peh. That we are not Tzedukim, we're not heretics. Heretics would never eat hot food Shabbos day because it would be impossible. But if you believe in the Oral Torah, then you believe you could eat hot food that was heated from before Shabbos. And in fact, we assume that that's a mitzvah. You should make the effort to eat hot food every Shabbos. We had a guest once who came up to me and said, oh, the person who's hosting me happens to not have made chalent, so I didn't have anything hot. Do you have hot water at your house that I could have a cup of so I could fulfill this mitzvah? I think that might have been taking it a little far. I don't know that it's a mitzvah that you have to, you know, it's a mitzvah like tasting the food on Erev Shabbos is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. But that's the origin of it. So malachas machsheves aser Torah. You're not allowed to do creative labor. That is what is aser. One of those creative labors, it's actually not listed in the Mishnah. If you ever looked at the 39 categories, they're the process of making bread, which concludes with baking. Not with cooking. Cooking is not listed, but it's a subcategory of the one of the categories. So cooking is prohibited on Shabbos. Now cooking means taking raw food and transforming it to be edible. That's the definition of cooking. But the definition is different for a solid and a liquid, right? If you look at a piece of chicken, You know if a piece of chicken's raw, and you know if a piece of chicken's cooked. How much does it have to be cooked to be called cooked? From a halachic perspective? So, the Gemara quotes a machlokas, maybe Ma'achal ben Drusai. Ben Drusai was a thief, a ganav. So the Gemara says that he was always on the run. He never had the luxury of allowing his food to cook. So he always cooked it till it was just beyond raw, edible enough, because he was always on the run. So the Chazal used him as the example of a level of food being cooked to be the minimal cooking. That's a big machlokas, Rashi, the Rambam. Does it mean a third cooked? Does it mean half cooked? Do you define a third or a half based on time or based on temperature, some other measure? So, Ma'achal ben Drusai. But we don't rely on Ma'achal ben Drusai anyway. For us, it has to be fully cooked to be called cooked. Less than fully cooked, contributing to the cooking process, you violate a cooking of Shabbos. Now, violating cooking of Shabbos doesn't just mean you took that raw piece of chicken and you put it in the oven. Cooking of Shabbos can also mean expediting, accelerating the cooking process. So, for example, something called Hagasa. Hagasa means stirring. Stirring is Asr on Shabbos, not Asr, you know, off the fire. But if you stir, you're not allowed to stir on the fire, and you can't stir something that's not fully cooked. Because by stirring something that's not fully cooked, you're accelerating the cooking process. If there's no lid on something that's not fully cooked, and you place a lid on it, you're accelerating the cooking process. If the door of the oven is open to something that's not fully cooked, we'll talk about ovens in a minute, and you close that door on Shabbos, you're accelerating the cooking process. So not only cooking, taking something from zero to cooked is cooking, is bishul, but accelerating or expediting the cooking process is also cooking. And that includes stirring, it includes putting the cover on a pot, closing a door, and so on. So you take a raw piece of chicken and you make it cooked, that's called cooked. What if you take a raw piece of chicken and you call it cooked and it's cooked, but by cooking it, you make it even more well done? Taking something fully cooked and making it more well done, is that mutter on Shabbos? So there's a big discussion in halacha called mitztamek v'yafalo, mitztamek v'ralo. Is furthering the cooking and it makes it better, or sometimes you continue the cooking and it makes it worse, right? There's certain dishes where if you continue to cook it, it's more flavorful, it's better, some people like things better cooked, and other things, if you keep cooking it, it keeps losing its taste. So that might determine whether that's called cooking on Shabbos or not. I'm throwing a lot of general principles at you because I'm trying to learn some Torah, and then we'll come to the practical in 1 second. So I'm just throwing some examples. There's also a difference in halacha between the categories of cooking. So there's cooking, there's baking, there's roasting, there's frying. If you did one thing to the food and then you do another, so let's say I roast the chicken in my oven and it's fully roasted, fully we'd call it cooked. Can I take that roasted piece of chicken and drop it into chicken soup in the pot on the fire, on a blech? That's a question of yesh bishul achar afiyah. Or take the opposite. Take the opposite. What if I have a cooked piece of chicken and now I want to roast it and heat it in a way which is going to cook? So we paskin, we follow the interpretation that the different types of cooking do add value even after the other category is complete. So for example, there's halachic challenges. If I take something that was previously fully baked and now I put it in a liquid, I'm now cooking something. Ah, it was fully baked already, but it wasn't cooked and now I'm cooking it. If I take something that was fully cooked and now I've baked it, roasted it, that also has a halachic impact. So a practical example where that comes up, again, I know I'm throwing a lot at you, I'm going to come back to the practical, but a practical example where that comes up is you take challah and you want to put it in your hot chicken soup. So can you put challah in your hot chicken soup? Yesh bishul achar afiyah. You're cooking the challah even after it was once already baked. So the answer is by the time it reaches your bowl, it's probably in a klishlishi, depending on the ladle, which we'll get back to also. What's the status of the ladle? So we'll get back to that in 1 second. I'm trying to give you some examples. Okay, so we said when it comes to a solid food, I understand, when it comes to the solid food, I understand what it means to take it from raw to cooked, and I understand that there's a difference between cooking, baking, roasting, frying. And that if I do any one of those things after a previous one was done, it can have an impact. What about a liquid? What determines if a liquid is cooked? If I boil water and then it cools, is the cold water cooked water? We'll get to tea in a second. So why am I asking you that question? Because the following very important principle. The Gemara says, Ein bishul achar bishul. You're not allowed to cook on Shabbos. That's the bad news. Or maybe the good news, depending on how you look at it. You're not allowed to cook on Shabbos. Once something is cooked, it can't be cooked again. So if I have a cooked piece of chicken, it can still be fried, roasted, or baked, But it can't be cooked again. A cooked piece of chicken can't be cooked again. A cooked kugel can't be cooked again. A cooked vegetables can't be cooked again. Pasta can't be cooked again. Whatever's cooked ain't bishel achar bishel. So what does that mean? It means that on Shabbos, I can't violate bishel with this piece of chicken. It's already been cooked. I can't cook it again. So what is the most that I'm worried about it is that I can't heat it in a way which resembles cooking. So if it's true that ain bishel achar bishel, I got my cooked piece of chicken and I've got a fire burning from before Shabbos, i.e. my oven is on or my stove, why can't I just put my chicken in the oven? Ain bishel achar bishel, cooked chicken can't be cooked further. And we already said we're not tzedukim, we're not Sadducees, we're Pharisees, we are students of the Oral Torah, Torah Sheba Peh. So if my fire is lit from before Shabbos, no problem there, I'm allowed to benefit from it. And my chicken which was cooked can't be cooked again, why can't I just put chicken in the oven?
It's enhancing the taste, doesn't it, more?
Let's say it's not enhancing the taste. The chicken has reached its maximum taste. It won't be enhanced. It won't be enhanced. It might even get worse, but it won't be enhanced. Mestamik v'ralo. So let's say no one's going to see it. I'm with Yocheved. We went away for Shabbos. We rented an island. There's no way on or off the island. No one will see it. That we're going away? I won't. Oh. Well, so what's the reason? So the Gemara has a principle called Mechzi Kamavasho. It looks like cooking. Mechzi is it looks like, it appears like cooking. Now it's different than what you said. It's different for the following reason. What you suggested is a problem of what we call marzayin.
Yeah.
Something looks wrong, and if someone sees it, they may emulate it. But one of two reasons. Marzayin has two reasons. Right? Why don't I go into a non-kosher place to get a cup of water? Preferably, I'm not talking about dehydrating and dying. But why don't why shouldn't I go into McDonald's when I'm driving out to Palmetto Park Road to buy a Diet Coke? Because, one of two reasons, either people will erroneously conclude, oh, I guess McDonald's is kosher, your rabbi went to get Diet Coke there. Or they'll conclude, I guess the rabbi's not such a rabbi, right? He's going to McDonald's. Either one is enough for me not to do something that gives the appearance. That's called marasayin. That's not why this is prohibited, because marasayin has its own set of rules called chadrei chadarim. Can you do things in a room that no one will see? So leave marasayin out. It's not because of marasayin. Mechzei kavavashal means I shouldn't habituate myself to do things which are like things that are prohibited. So I shouldn't get in the habit of putting a cooked piece of chicken in an oven, because what's going to happen 3 years later on a Shabbos? I'm going to put a raw piece of chicken in the oven. If I'm in the habit of putting a cooked piece of chicken in the oven, I'm going to end up putting not a fully cooked, not, forget even on purpose. It's not that I took an Empire chicken out of the package, right? I took a piece of chicken that was mostly cooked and I didn't realize it was raw on the inside and I put that in too. So the rabbi said you can't heat food in a place where it was previously, in a place which is similar or emulates the act of cooking. Can't do that on Shabbos. Even though ain bishel achar bishel, even though what you have, your food is fully cooked and can't be cooked again, but heating it in a manner which resembles cooking will habituate you in a process, an act like cooking, and you're going to come to cook. So midrabbanan, they said you can't heat even fully cooked food. How can you heat fully cooked food any way that doesn't resemble cooking? So what are examples of ways that don't resemble cooking? On a blach. Now a blach is not a simple thing. We'll get back to the blach in a second. But I'll give you an example. If you lived in New York, lo aleinu, and nobody's listening. Yeah? If you live in New York and you have a radiator, remember how hot those radiators? I don't know how they're safe. I don't know how there's no recall. People burn themselves. Right? The metal radiator, the thick piping metal radiator, you could boil water on top of that metal radiator. Are you allowed to put a piece of chicken or a kugel there on Shabbos morning? Absolutely. Yes. Because nobody cooks on a radiator. Remember, the issue... Now, we're talking about a cooked solid. A cooked solid. We'll come back to a liquid in a moment. Can I put a raw piece of chicken on my radiator?
No.
It's cooking. It's bishul. It's one of the 39 categories of forbidden labor. It's midoraisa. It's biblically prohibited. Can I put a fully cooked piece of chicken or kugel on a radiator on Shabbos?
No.
Absolutely. Rav Moshe Feinstein came along, and Rav Moshe Feinstein Igros Moshe says that a hot plate is just a smooth radiator. He didn't give this analogy. I'm giving it to you. But what did he say about the plata? Nobody cooks on a plata. ah, my plata gets so hot that I have to put three tins upside down because it's going to burn my food. It doesn't matter how hot, just like my radiator, because the issue when I have fully cooked food is not cooking it. You can't cook fully cooked food. Ain't bishel achar bishel. The issue is not the heat level. The issue is it a place that people normally cook? And Rav Moshe said a hot plate is not a place people normally cook. Now you still have to be careful about the knob, said Rav Moshe, because you may come to adjust the knob, so you have to cover the knob. If you have an adjustable hot plate, then you have to adjust it. Then you have to cover it to make sure that you won't come to adjust it. But solid food, you could heat there because it's not a place that people cook. What's another example of where people don't cook?
I knew people who put on top of their crock pot, they would take the peas, you know, that were in their little plastic bag where you would cook peas anyway.
Right.
And they put it on top.
They would have to be fully cooked if they want to heat them. If they're raw peas, it could be a problem.
But can I ask them?
Hold the question. Let me just finish the train of thought and then we'll come back.
Hold the question.
So again, we're talking about you have fully cooked solid foods. Chicken, kugel, vegetables, pasta. Fully cooked solid food. Because you can't cook something cooked again, can be heated at any place where people don't normally cook. So kedera al gabe kedera, a pot on top of a pot. Who cooks by putting a pot on top of a pot? Nobody. There's such a thing as double boiling? Steaming. Okay, maybe if you're steaming or baking. But you wouldn't normally...
Right.
You wouldn't cook. So kedera agave kedera, according to most opinion, but kedera agave kedera is a permissible way. So if you want to put... You take your potato kugel out in tinfoil and you want to put it on top of the crock pot, on top of the lid, and it's going to heat it. Doesn't matter how hot the lid is. Nobody normally cooks it. A blech. Talk about the blech.
On Shabbos. Not the
On Shabbos. We're talking about Shabbos day.
Yeah.
Shabbos morning, you wake up before you go to shul or when you come home from shul, your chicken, you want to serve hot food because you want to prove that you believe in the Oral Torah. So you want to heat up food. How are you going to heat up food? If it's fully cooked and dry, remember we're not talking about liquid. Mm-hmm. Fully cooked and dry, you can heat it in any way which is not mechzik mevashel. So another example is a blech.
An example.
Yes.
Right. Or you could defrost food, but we actually, like if it's really hot and our car's outside, you could put cooked like deli meat or something that's, I mean it's frozen, you could stick it on top of your car and it's actually, it's heated up. It's
right, the hood of your car could heat it. Right, that your hood of your
here's
car.
Here's
right. Right. In the summer here too. Yeah. The Gemara has a whole discussion about that. If you cook something based on the orachama, when the sun heats it, if the sun heats a piece of metal, can you cook it? Not. They're not talking about heating fully cooked food. It's even talking about if you cracked an egg, is that bishel? Because you don't have a fire. It's the fire of the sun. But leave that out. So, but you're right. Could you use the hood of the car? Could you use the sidewalk? Could you use the radiator? You could use the plata. You could use the top of your pot. And you could use a warming drawer. That's what we'll get to this. A warming drawer, according to most poskim, is permissible to heat food for the following reason. You don't cook in a warming drawer. The warming drawer may have multiple settings. It may even get very hot. But you don't cook in a warming drawer. If you don't cook in a warming drawer, it's not a place that you normally cook. You're allowed to heat food. Now, I do want to give this disclaimer. The Star K is machmir on warming drawers. Okay. Rabbi Heinemann is machmir on warming drawers for the following reason. I don't want to confuse you, but he believes the issue is not a cooking issue. The issue is that when you open the warming drawer and allow the cold air in, you're forcing it to kick in. When you close the warming drawer and you heat, it's going to turn off. So Rabbi Heinemann is machmir, and he holds that that's different than a refrigerator, for whatever technical reasons. But you should know that many posts can disagree. And for some reason, the Star K opinion on this got out there as if that's the only opinion. When Rav David Cohen, the Gvul Yaivitz, one of the biggest posts of our generation, was at my house for Shabbos, I asked him about the warming drawer, without pointing out the one in our kitchen. And he told me that absolutely it's permissible, and he told his wife uses a warming drawer. For David Cohen uses a warming drawer, it's certainly good enough for me. Rabbi Will, others allow a warming drawer too. So leave aside the whole cold air issue, because Rabbi David Cohen says it is like a refrigerator. Same way you can open your refrigerator because it's indirect. The air may or may not trigger it to turn on. It's called a davar she'eino mischavein, not a psik resha, so it's permissible. So Rabbi David Cohen has no problem with a warming drawer. You could most certainly rely on it. Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, the CRC, has no problem with a warming drawer. Many poskim have no problem with warming drawers. And a warming drawer is an excellent place. So I actually don't recommend the blech. I'll talk about the blech right now. And I'll tell you why in a moment. To me, a warming drawer or a plata are the easiest ways to heat. I mean a blech on a stove, a piece of sheet metal on a stove. And the reason I don't recommend it is the following. Most people mistakenly think that by covering the stove, I can now put fully cooked dry food anywhere on the blech. And that's not the case. There's three areas, halachically, on the blech. There's what's called al ha'esh, on the fire, wherever on top of the heat source of the blech. There's off the fire, but to an area where it reaches yad seledes below 110 degrees. And then there's the third area, which means on the blech, but to an area where it can't even reach 110 degrees. The only place that you're allowed to put fully cooked dry food on Shabbos on a blech is the third area, where it can't reach 110 degrees.
Even though a hot plate is
at Seledes Bo, because again, when you're talking about the blech and the fire, you're coming dangerously close to the issue of the appearance of cooking. Mm-hmm. On the plata, you're not. There's no appearance of cooking.
So you're saying that like you cannot warm up chava at the area that is more than 110 degrees.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Now the Sfardi halacha is a little bit different.
Yeah,
it's not entirely. Rav Avadya actually is much more makel on these issues. Mm-hmm. Rav Avadya has a lot of kulas on these issues.
What if you would put something on top of? Even on the beach, like if you put a tin upside down, so no one looks that way.
Right. If you put a tin upside down on the blech over the fire.
Yeah. Oh no.
I still think it's a problem, but I'm not positive. I still think it's a problem. But because the blech, it's so confusing, right? I don't know anyone who's come with a laser gun to measure where the area is exactly that it doesn't reach 110. It's confusing where to leave the food. It mysteriously makes its way around. It's hard to know on the fire, off the fire, and the third area. To me, and again, it's perfectly halachic for centuries, Jewish women, Jewish households, heated food using a blech on a fire. Far be it from, I grew up in a home that used a blech every Shabbos. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the blech, I'm just saying that we've advanced, we go to the store and buy a plata, there were no platas growing up, when we were growing up, so we've advanced where we have warming drawers now, that it's much easier, and I know that not every kitchen has a warming drawer, not everybody's redoing their kitchen, but a plata is the best investment you'll ever make. Either you can buy a hot plate. Before we ever had these, you know, the Israeli, the real plata, we had just a regular, you know, like a hot plate. Get, you know, just generic hot plate that non-Jews use. Or you can get the plata that only Jews use. But either way, that to me is the easiest way because it means any dry, fully cooked food can be taken out of the refrigerator anytime on Shabbos and put directly on that plata or in that warming drawer.
So you don't need to put something that's happened
in the warming drawer?
No.
No. Yeah, some people think you should. It says a lot of things, I'm sure, in Hilchot Shabbat. It's one opinion, but according to some opinions, you should, but according to many other opinions, including Rav Avadya, it's unnecessary. Yes. Ashkenazim.
That's why I'm here. I just wanted to learn more about the halacha.
That's a good question. Yeah. If a Sephardi is hosting a Ashkenazi,
or the other
can they heat food using the Sephardi leniencies, and the Ashkenazi is going to benefit?
Right.
It's a good question. My instinct is to say to be sensitive to the Ashkenazi way of heating things, right. Although I will look into it, and I wouldn't be shocked if the answer is, as long as you're heating it in a way that's permissible for you, the other person doesn't need to ask or know or... In other words, they can rely on you doing it, but I reserve the right to look into that. I'm not positive. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Yeah.
To that, if you're at someone's house and you...
Oh, we'll come back to that. Hold on. Let me get through the whole. I'll make a mental note or someone write it down. Okay. If you're invited to someone's house and you see they're heating things the wrong way, right? That's the big question that I don't want to answer, but that's the big question. So let's come back to this. I'm trying to do this methodically. So you have dry, fully cooked food. Ein bishel achar bishel. You can't cook after cooking. So what's the issue? It's mechzik and mevashel, that you can't heat it in a place that is similar to cooking. Heating it anywhere which is dissimilar to cooking, i.e. a radiator, a warming drawer, the third area of the blech, on top of a pot, or the hood of Jessica's car. Any of those areas are the sun. Any of those areas do not give the appearance of cooking, and therefore it's permissible to heat the food, no matter how hot it gets, or no matter where you took it from. You could take it right out of the fridge and put it there. That's true for dry, solid foods. So now let's talk about where you can't put the dry, solid food. Right? I tried to do it in the positive, where you can. Where can you not put the dry, solid food? On a stove, because that's exactly like cooking. And where else looks like cooking? The oven. See, even if your oven was left on from before Shabbos, And even if your oven is a Shabbos mode oven, so opening and closing the door doesn't impact kicking it in or not, but since an oven is a place that is, people cook, when you take even fully cooked food and heat it in an oven, that's mechzik mavashel, that's prohibited on Shabbos.
So can you not eat it if, like,
we'll get to that in 1 second. So if you're saying, hold off, hold off.
What do you consider dry salt?
Oh, have, come back to that in 1 second also. Yeah, for sure. You can put it out in the sun, no problem. Put it on your car, you can put it out in the sun. So the oven is a problem. The oven is a problem to heat things. There's one exception, and I don't want to confuse you, and I say this because while this isn't the mainstream position, this was Rabbi Brander's position, so anyone who remembers it, it's certainly obviously a legitimate position, and it's based on a interpretation of the Rav's position. The Ramah in Shulchan Aruch quotes a Mordechai, who says, if you're going to get confused by this, don't listen. But the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch quotes a Mordechai who says that if you had fully cooked food in an oven during Bein HaShemashos, meaning at candlelighting time, even if you later took it out, you could put it back in an oven on Shabbos. It's the opinion of the Mordechai for whatever reason. So understand that even that lenient opinion is only in the following circumstance. That the very food you had in Friday night when you were lighting candles, that you took out, and that you put it back in the oven, and only into an oven, by the way, where the knobs are covered and where the heating element's covered. To me, again, it's a minority opinion to begin with, and even if you believe in that opinion, the scenario is so unlikely and so confusing and leads to people thinking that you could heat food in an oven, disregard what I just said. And work off the assumption that you can't heat food in an oven on Shabbos day. Well, can you on Friday night? In other words, candlelighting is 6 o'clock. You're going to leave your oven on, have your cooked food in your oven. It has to be fully cooked for this to work. And you're going to light candles, make Shabbos, and then you're going to serve dinner. You're going to open the oven door, take the food out, and use it. Can you do that? Yes. It's not a problem. Now again, the Star K, and here most poskim are machmir, that if you're going to do that, you have to take all the contents of the oven out in one shot. You can't take out the first course and close the door and the next course and close the door and the next course, because each time you're opening and closing the oven door, you're creating a problem.
What if
it's a Shabbos mode, then you're not doing it, then you would be able to take it out. If the oven's off, for sure, you can take it out in stages. Yeah, if the oven's off, for sure. Yeah, but you're not kicking in electricity. Exactly. Okay, so... Yeah, if it's in Shabbos mode where you're not impacting it, then you can take it out in stages. If it was fully cooked before Shabbos and in the oven before Shabbos, you can take it out in stages.
Even but, though the oven is still going on?
Yeah, it's off. I mean, it's off.
No,
it's Shabbos.
The Shabbos mode oven is not impacted by your opening or closing the door.
You have to take it out.
The oven is on in Shabbos mode.
Yeah.
But it's on. It's not. I didn't put it on time bake. It's on.
Okay.
I can.
My understanding of Shabbos mode, though, means that opening and closing the door don't impact it. Right? I have a Shabbos refrigerator. We didn't even buy it on purpose. It actually literally has a button that says Shabbos mode. You press it, the light goes off, and it also means that opening and closing the door will not impact the motor. So that's the way the Shabbos mode oven also.
If I have food in the oven, and I take out for Friday night, I can leave it chilling in there cooking for Shabbos day?
Yeah. Now, if the challah, there's a separate issue, the challah would have had to have been fully cooked before Shabbos.
Yes.
Then it could stay in there until Shabbos day. Yeah. Yeah. Okay? So, again, that's the oven. I think there's a tremendous misnomer. There's a lot of people who heat food in an oven on Shabbos day because they don't realize. But that's our job to educate. Kol hakavod to you. You're all here tonight. It's not complicated. Get a plata and a warming drawer. Don't use your oven on Shabbos, and you're good to go. It's not complicated.
When you talk about the food being fully cooked,
yes,
then fully cooked. If you want it to cook longer, but it's fully cooked, that's okay. Like you like when your chicken is
really dried out and crispier, right? So if it's crispier, it could be. It's complicated. It's more
for Friday night.
To leave it in, you mean,
yeah.
Or to put it back?
Leave it in.
No, you could leave it in, that's fine. If it was in from before Shabbos,
it's in from before Shabbos.
Fully cooked,
but what
yes.
If it's not fully cooked? Friday night,
from before shops.
So then you'd have to cover the knobs, and then it would be okay to leave it in. You know what's called grufu ketuma. So they get that's the machlok is a third or a half machlok ben drusai or not, and how do you measure the third or the half? So get it fully cooked. Get it fully cooked. Okay, so that's dry food. So again, I keep repeating it, trying to bring this home. Dry, fully cooked food, you can't cook on Shabbos. Once it's cooked, it's cooked. Our only concern is how to heat it. Concern in heating it is that you want to avoid mechzik mavasha, that it looks like cooking or is similar to cooking. So it means you can heat any fully cooked dry food in any place that doesn't resemble cooking, like a radiator, a hood, a hot plate, a warming drawer, or the third area of the blech. Where can you not heat it because it looks exactly like cooking? A stovetop or an oven, right? So you can't put cold, fully cooked dry food in an oven on Shabbos. What about Friday night? If it was in from before Shabbos and it's fully cooked, then you can certainly, if the oven's off, take it out. Even if the oven's on, if it's not Shabbos mode, you take everything out in one shot. If the oven's on and it's in Shabbos mode, then you can take it out in stages. Okay, so that's dry, fully cooked food. That's ovens 101. Liquids. I asked you before, how do you define fully cooked for a liquid? If you heat a liquid and then it cools. So when it comes to chicken soup, I understand. I start with water, I add ingredients, I cook it. Even when it's cold, I call that cooked liquid, it's chicken soup. But if I boil water and then it cools, and I boil it and it cools, and I boil it and it cools, the cold water, is that cooked water? So our rabbis also, it's a machlokas. Yesh b'shalach b'shal b'davalach? Do we believe there's cooking after cooking for a liquid? Or ain b'shalach b'shal b'davalach? Or is there no cooking after cooking for liquid, just like for a solid? We are strict on that opinion. And we assume that there is cooking after cooking for a liquid. Which is why you cannot heat a liquid on Shabbos day. Because if you take a liquid from cool to hot, you've now violated Bishul. You've now cooked on Shabbos. So even in the unusual place, if I take a cold pot of water and put it on a radiator, even though it doesn't look like a place of cooking, it cooked! If I take a cold pot of water and I put it on top of another pot, even though it doesn't look like cooking, I cooked. There, we care about the result, and the result is I can't cook. A liquid heated beyond a certain place, yesh bishul achar bishul, we believe there is cooking.
What about tea cakes?
Yeah, what? Hold on. So that all I'm talking about right now is in primary utensils. It's called a kli rishon. A kli rishon means the primary utensil for cooking, like a pot on a fire, a kettle, a pan in an oven, and so on. So now the real question, Susie asked this before, what's the difference between dry food and liquid food? Yavesh and lach. When do I define it as dry? When do I define it as liquid? For example, chicken, when it's cold, the sauce will congeal and look solid. You start to heat it, and all of a sudden you've got a little flood on the bottom of the pan because there's a lot of liquid it produces. So do you go after the end where it became a lot of liquid? Or do you go after the beginning where it was a solid? So Rav Avadia, for example, here is Mako. Rav Avadia holds for sure it's not a problem. The Ashkenazi poskim say, if it's a little bit, does it produce a lot of liquid that someone would look at that and say, that's chicken in a sauce? Or someone would look at that and say, that's chicken, anything heated produces moisture. You take dry chicken, you wrap it in aluminum foil, you heat it in one of these places, you open the aluminum foil, on the bottom you're going to have some liquid. That's not liquid, even for Ashkenazi poskim. Everything's going to produce some moisture. Right? So exactly where's the threshold, if you'd call it saucy or liquidy or that it has a liquid, exactly where's the threshold is difficult to define, but you know it when you see it. You know, if it's essentially, you take corned beef and you heat it, it's going to produce liquid on the bottom, but that's okay to heat, you know, because you're not heating something and so on. Okay? That's the difference between solids and liquids.
So what's the difference between the gravy stuff for beef or Chinese stuff for chicken? Chinese stuff means
so I wouldn't call liquid something which sticks to the chicken. So a Chinese, like General Tso's chicken, doesn't have liquid. It has a sauce, like a flavor. Like if you held the piece of chicken, it wouldn't start dripping. Whereas something that had a liquid, if you lifted it, the liquid would drip off of it. So that's an example. Okay, so that's the difference between yavesh and lach, a dry food and a liquid food. Ain b'shalach b'shal, yesh b'shalach b'shal. All of this determines where you can heat food, where you can't heat food, mechzik mevashal, and so on. Yeah.
Something that let's say it's a beef
in a liquid. You want to eat it Shabbos day, so you remove the meat from the liquid.
Right.
You leave the liquid.
Not a problem. Correct.
Even though there's going to be residual.
So even if on Friday night, I'll give you this example. Friday night you served a chicken in a sauce. It was in a pan with sauce. Mm-hmm. You put it in the refrigerator, the leftovers on Shabbos, and there's all congealed whatever around it. Take the chicken, the fork out, put it in a new piece of tin foil, and heat it that way. Ah, it's going to have little bits of the congealed part to it. That's going to produce. That's okay. That's okay. That's not boder. You're taking the good from the bad. We'll get the boder. Three conditions of boder. That wouldn't be separating. Okay. Next. Everything we've discussed thus far is in the kli rishon, a primary utensil for cooking. So the pot on the fire, the kettle on the fire, the pan on the fire, and so on. That's where cooking happens. What happens when I take the pot off the fire? Can that still cook? So I have my chicken soup that's sitting on the blech or the stove or the hot plate on Friday night. That's the primary place of cooking. Can I take raw food and put it in the chicken soup while it's on the fire? No, that's cooking. Can I take baked croutons and put them in the chicken soup while it's in the pot on the fire? No, why? Ah, they're already baked. Because yesh b'shalach rafia. They may have been baked already, but they weren't cooked. I can't cook after baking. I can't put croutons in the soup on the fire. I can't stir the soup on the fire, right? And the lid, I shouldn't be taking on and off on the fire either. So what do? I take my chicken soup off the fire. Now I have a kli rishon that's not al gabei ha'esh. Yes.
Would that be true if it was on a hot plate as well?
Yeah. Yeah. In other words, for these purposes, it produces enough heat, that's called al ha'esh. When I take the chicken soup off the fire, the hot plate, the blech, the whatever the case, the heat source, that's called the kli rishon, the primary utensil, off the fire. That still has the ability to cook something. So there too, I can't... Let's say I made chicken soup for Friday night, but I didn't want to be fleshic all Friday afternoon. So I just bluffed it. Now I heard Kiddush Friday night, and before I serve the chicken soup, I take a little taste, because I want to see whether I need to add spices. And I learn I need to add spices. Can I add spices in the same pot? No. Because the primary pot has the ability to cook, even when it's off the fire. Thank you so much. Even when it's off the fire. So I can't add raw spice into a pot, because it could cook even off the fire. The same would be true with the croutons. Okay? Yeah, salt, pepper, meaning it's not cooked yet. Things that were previously. No, even when it's off the fire, you can't add it into the pot itself, because the pot has the ability to cook even off the fire. So you can't add the spot right in the pot. That's what's called the kli rishon. A kli rishon is very powerful and has the ability to cook. Iroi kli rishon also has the ability to cook. Iroi means pouring from the kli rishon. So let's say I take the pot of hot chicken soup, I just took it off the fire, and now I tilt it and I want it spill or pour hot chicken soup from my pot into a bowl, and let's say the bowl has cold droplets of cold water because the bowls were just washed. That's a problem because I'm cooking the water, because pouring from a kli rishon also has the ability to cook. There's a technicality, you can only cook kedei klipa, it only can cook not the entire way through something, only a little bit through something, but again, leave that aside for a moment. Okay, so when you pour. If you're taking seconds of chicken soup from the pot off the fire and you're saying that you have the cold droplets of the chicken soup on the bottom of your bowl and now you're going to add to it. Right. So, good. So that brings us to the ladle. The ladle. The golden ladle. Which could save the day here. So we get to... That's the primary vessel. So if I take food, it's in the primary vessel, and I pour it into a second vessel, it's now called a kli shen, the second vessel. Does the second vessel have the ability to cook food? Can I pour spices and croutons and raw chicken into my second vessel? So the Gemara says that a kli sheni has the ability... Oh, wait, that's what it was. You'll tell me when we should stop. A kli sheni has the ability to cook kalei habishal, meaning foods that are particularly susceptible to cooking. And the Gemara gives a list of what some of those are. And then the Gemara says, but we've lost the exact tradition of what those foods are. So we treat everything as being able to be cooked in a kli sheni. So we believe that the kli sheni has the ability to cook too in it. One of the examples, by the way, that the Gemara has of things that certainly can be cooked in a kli sheni are tea leaves, which is why you can't make it in a kli sheni, you're cooking. We generally pass in a kli sheni does not have the ability to cook. Tosfos gives the following interesting reason. Why does a kli rishon have the ability to cook even when it's off the fire? Because since I heated the pot with what's in it, the walls of the pot remain hot and they continue to contribute to the food in it, and the food has the capacity to now cook any new food introduced to it. But when I pour that into a kli sheni, which is a vessel that's cold, the cold walls of the vessel, say Tosfos, are drawing the heat from the food inside it, and the food inside the new second kli is fighting to stay warm itself. It can't also cook something new that's added to it. That's Tosfos' reasoning. It's a debate, but that's Tosfos' reasoning. So the general rule is that a kli sheni can't cook. But the Gemara says there are, kaliyad bishol, there are a few things it can. We're not exactly sure what those few things are, so we don't cook anything, even in a kli sheni. What about a kli shishi? I now pour something from my second utensil into a third utensil. Does my third utensil have the ability to cook?
No.
So this is a machlokas between Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Chazon Ish. Rav Moshe Feinstein, they both looked at the same Gemara and drew the opposite conclusions. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, well, the Gemara said that a kli sheni, and it didn't mention anything beyond that. So it must be anything beyond that can't cook. Kli shlishi, kli revi, kli chamishi, keep pouring from one vessel into another. By transferring so many times, you keep drawing out the heat, that what's left doesn't have the ability to cook anything new. That was Rav Moshe's opinion. Chazon Ish said, no. The Gemara stopped at kli sheni because it meant anything after that is like a kli sheni. So you can pour it a third, a fourth, a fifth, 400 times, it still has that same status like a kli sheni. It has the ability to cook. That was the Chazon Ish. What's a practical consequence between the Chazon Ish and Rav Moshe? How to make tea. That's why Rav Moshe says, how can you make tea on Shabbos? You're cooking. The tea leaves are raw. Not true, by the way, when you make coffee. If you're making instant coffee, the coffee's already cooked. Ein bishel achar bishel. Your coffee's cooked already. But tea leaves are raw. No, you don't need kli shlishi for coffee because the coffee's cooked already. Well, if you're adding milk, then the milk can be complicated. But tea leaves are raw. Tea leaves are raw. So tea leaves can't be cooked in a kli sheni. And says the Chazon Ish, every subsequent kli is like a kli sheni, so you can't make tea on Shabbos. For the Chazon Ish, the only way you can make tea is by making tea, what do you call it, tea scents. You make a very potent pot of lots of tea bags in one little amount, and you pour that and add more water, and that's how you have your bad tea on Shabbos. You're saying that the tea scents, which is cool, you're heating. Right, so why for the Chazon Ish? Is that okay in the kli shlishi? Right, it's a good question. Why for the Chazon Ish is that okay?
And also, what does he do with Tosfos?
What does he do with? Because he's relying on, he's assuming that everything is. Tosfos said that for things that are not vulnerable to be cooked in a kli sheni. We're strict to assume that everything may be those few things that can be. That's what Tosfos says for most things, but not for everything. And we're worried that our everything are like the exceptions that the Gemara was talking about. The Gemara said that generally you can't cook in a kli sheni. Tosfos gave us the reason why. But there are a few things that do cook even in a kli sheni. We come along and say, we don't know exactly what those few things are, so we treat everything that you can't cook in a kli sheni, even though that reason should apply. So the Chazon Ish is strict. But Rav Moshe Feinstein, you can make tea in a kli shlishi. We make tea in my home in a kli shlishi, which means that you pour water from your kettle or your urn into one cup. You pour it from that cup into a second cup. Second cup becomes the third vessel that held that water. And then you could add the tea. Now, but you have to remember the order to do it. Put the tea bag in afterwards. Because if the tea bag's in the cup and you pour from the second cup into that cup, now you have iroi kli sheni, pouring from a kli sheni. So you have to put the tea bag in afterwards. First the hot water, then the tea bag and the sugar or the sweetener, whatever the case may be. Okay, so those are some of the rules of the kli sheni and kli shlishi. Now come back to the label, ladle for a moment. Because you asked before, who asked? When you refill the soup bowl, you can have the droplets of the soup. So the answer is the ladle. What's the status of a ladle? Is a ladle a kli sheni turning your soup bowl into a kli shlishi? Or is the ladle like a kli rishon? So the post can point out, it all depends on how long you leave the ladle in the soup pot. If you use the ladle just to serve, and in between serving it's sitting next to the soup pot, then the ladle's a kli sheni, and your bowl's a kli shlishi, and you can add anything you want to the bowl. Add your challah, add your croutons, add raw spices, and the fact that there were droplets of old soup don't matter. If your ladle sits in your hot pot, and then you're using it, it's an extension of the kli rishon, then your soup bowl's only a kli sheni. And then if your guests start putting in challah, There can be questions. So don't leave your ladle in your pot. That's the moral of the story. Yeah. I think as long as it's Yad's lettuce bowl. Can be.
So if you can touch it,
right, then it's not. A normal sense of touch, and you can touch it, right. Okay, so that's the rules with soup, ladle, kli rishon, kli shlishi, kli sheni, kli shlishi. Understand that because a kli shlishi can't cook a corner of Moshe, you can make oatmeal that way on Shabbos morning. You can make... Right, lush is a whole separate malacha. We could talk about that, how to make it, the crisscross pattern and issues of lush. But leave aside the malacha of kneading. So come up with another example of something that you would...
Oatmeal you can make?
But in theory, yeah. Oatmeal, baby food, certain things in a kli shlishi.
Hot cocoa?
Yeah. Yeah. In other words, you could take a raw piece of chicken and put it into water in a kli shlishi. Ramosha's of the opinion that a kli shlishi can't cook.
Sometimes the water is like too hot. Like you really feel if you put your finger in it burns.
Correct.
You.
But if you're... Why should a kli shlishi help? Because Rav Moshe, combined with the Tosfos, would say, by the time that it gets to the kli shlishi, it's holding on for dear life to that heat. So even though it feels hot to you, it doesn't have the ability to truly cook something else. It's Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe certainly you can rely on for a kli shlishi. Yes?
If the pasta is already cooked, can you add hot water to make it warm? It's cooked already. And the blood
if pasta was previously cooked,
it's already
fully dry, fully cooked on Shabbos, and now you want to heat it.
Right, but the blood is going to burn it, and the kids don't like it too.
So you can pour boiling water on it?
Yes.
So
that's what you want.
Or put it in a cliche and you boiling water? Yeah.
You can do that, right?
Yeah, because it's fully cooked already. That's like heating it on a radiator. Mm-hmm. Nobody cooks by putting things in a cliche.
Even if it's on the
not on the fire, off the fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
please. Off the fire.
Then
yeah.
You
strain
it, right?
No,
your
straining
is
it.
Yeah. No, your question is
how would you strain it?
How would you strain it?
Right. With a fork, you would have to. Right.
You could do it with your hands.
You could do it with your hands. Yeah. I mean, it depends how hot the water is. Okay. That's in terms of heating things. Let's get back. Yes.
If you have an apple tart that's hot.
What?
An apple tart.
Apple tart. What's an apple tart? Like a baked apple?
No.
Apple pie? Apple pie, okay. Right, that's okay.
And then you put ice cream on it.
Yes.
Can you put ice cream on a hot apple pie with a cook?
So let's say the apple pie was fully cooked and is dry, right? An apple pie is liquidy or is dry?
It's
dry. So you're able to heat it on a plaka, and now you want to put ice cream on top.
You take it from the oven.
Right.
It's on a Friday night, and you take it out.
I think the again, I would want to look it up, but I'm pretty sure the answer is yes, because the ice cream was also previously cooked.
Milk is
pasteurized, which means it's previously cooked, which is why coffee is not a problem.
Yeah.
Right. The milk or ice cream was previously cooked too. Yeah. Ein bishul acha bishul. Yeah. So you'd be allowed to. Yes. Yeah. I was getting so hungry. Right.
Plata
right.
For dessert.
Right.
But the chocolate chips kind of melt.
They're not a liquid.
Well,
they're not. Yeah, that's fine.
Chocolate chip.
Yeah, I think that's okay. The inside is all liquidy, like that. The one where you cut it and then it runs all over your plate. That's probably liquidy. Right. That right. The cake that has on the inside like fudge, where if you cut it and it runs all over your plate, that's liquidy. But this is just that they melt a little bit. I think is okay. Softens it. Yeah, I think that's okay.
I think that was a good way to differentiate the sediment. If you hold it up and it drips.
Right. Versus the sauce sticks on.
If you're holding up an apple pie, is it going to drip? No.
Right.
It's not. Even if it's a little runny inside.
Exactly.
Right.
So here's, maybe we'll end with this. Yeah.
What about, I don't know the answer to this, that's why I'm asking, a food that is edible raw, for instance,
sure.
A carrot or
right.
Spinach or something like that, what is the Shabbos?
Still cooking. Your distinction between raw and you're thinking about bishul akum. In the world of bishul akum, that a non-Jew can't cook for you, anything that's edible raw, if the non-Jew cooked it, it's still okay to eat. But in the world of Shabbos, it doesn't matter if it's edible raw. If you cooked it, you cooked it. You got a problem. Okay, maybe we'll end with the big question, the $64,000 question. If you're eating at someone's house, they invite you over, you innocently go, you love them, you know them, and lo and behold, you see them taking food out of the oven on Shabbos day that they've been heating up in the oven. Or they serve you something with a liquid Shabbos day. Or whatever the case may be. So what do you do? What do you do in those complicated situations?
You see that someone put food in the microwave.
They put it in the microwave? They put it in, or they had the non-Jew put it in?
The non-Jew.
Yeah. So the non-Jew maybe we'll leave. I don't know how many more, a lot of more weeks you want to do this. We, I mean, there's 39 malachas, and we barely scratched Okay, we barely scratched the surface of Bishul. There's still like a million more things to talk about, like Hachzara. How can you take something off and put it back? What? No, I don't want to leave any more questions. But that's fine. We can do it as many as you want, as many as people are interested. So, no, but Amira La'akum, that's a very important one. What do you do if you have non-Jewish help? What are you allowed to ask them to do? What are you not allowed to ask them to do? What if they do, are you not allowed to benefit from? What if they do, are you allowed to? That's a whole class unto itself. So let's do that one too. But coming back to this. So this is a really tough question. This is a really tough question. A really tough question. There's a concept the Gemara has called Maisa Shabbos. Maisa Shabbos means if a malacha was done on Shabbos, you're not allowed to benefit from it. The person who did the malacha can never benefit from it. And others can benefit from it only after Shabbos, after the amount of time it would have taken them to do the malacha. That's Maisa Shabbos. You can't benefit for someone who does a malacha on Shabbos. They can't ever benefit from it. And everyone else can't benefit from it for till after Shabbos for the time it would take to do it. What's called Maisa Shabbos? So the Prima Gadim, one of the commentaries in the back of the Shulchan Aruch, the Prima Gadim has an opinion that as long as there's even a minority opinion that something is permissible, it won't be Maisa Shabbos. Meaning, if someone did it for you, it won't be prohibited. You shouldn't do it. You should inspire and motivate and educate your friend not to do it. But if they did it, it won't be prohibited to you as Maisa Shabbos as long as the minority opinion that something is permissible. That's a very important rule to remember when trying to answer this question. And the question is complicated. We're not going to answer it to your satisfaction tonight because you can't think of every scenario. You know, what if they serve jelly beans that they separated? What if they, you know, there's a lot of different malachas and a lot of different opinions. But the rule is, as long as there's even a minority opinion which allows for something and the person is doing it for you, you'd be allowed to benefit from it. So, yeah.
What?
I can give an example. Okay. I can give an example.
Well, let's just say something in the oven. Let's just say you went somewhere and they were heating. It was dry, it was everything, but they used their oven to heat.
So if someone heated fully cooked food in an oven on Shabbos in a way they shouldn't have, wait for it to cool and you can eat it with no halacha questions. Mm-hmm. You're not benefiting from their having heated it.
It was fully cooked before Shabbos.
If it was fully cooked before Shabbos and they heated it inappropriately in an oven, once it cools, you're not benefiting from their having heated it. It cools to the point that you're not benefiting from it. Room temperature, a little above room temperature, it's not. You're not benefiting from eating hot food that they heated. So that's the first. You might have to make more conversation before you get to the food on your plate, or pass that piping hot thing after it cooled. You have to figure it out. So maybe they're relying on the Rama and the Mordechai, and they had it in Ben Ashmashas, and it's unlikely.
No, not that Rama. Like, what if there was hot food, or not hot food, it was like cold food that they put in during Ben Ashmashas?
And it's been in since then until Shabbos lunch?
No, Friday night.
If you're eating Friday night, there's much less questions Friday night because people generally will start heating the food before they light candles, so I think.
But
what
are
you all eating? But you saw them do it. In other words, you went to someone's house, they lit candles, and you saw them put food in the oven already on Friday night.
On Shabbos Morabit.
Yeah. So again, if you want to rely on just let the food cool, it's a terrible misnomer.
It
should be called the Yontif mode because it's really a Yontif mode, it's not a Shabbos mode. So I think it would be the same rule. In other words, if it cooled, for sure you're not benefiting from it having been heated and you'd be okay.
Does the same apply to a liquid?
Okay. Oh, so now when it comes to a liquid.
Going back to the salad,
you can't just
challah if they put a challah in.
They put a challah in an oven.
On Saturday.
On Saturday, yeah. So There it's a little harder because they make hamotzi, they hand you the challah. You're not going to wait 10 minutes before you take your bite. Sit quietly.
I have a question.
What?
If the oven is off, but it's heated before, like let's say you put it on 500, you just want right. to make sure that the oven is off.
Right.
It's like warm. Would you be able to put the challah in after?
You turn the oven off, but it's hot.
Yes.
And you put, and you want to know if you can put challah
right,
in.
Or like a cooked food in it, and it's off now.
I think it has to have been in from before. I think you can't.
Nesina
lechatchila. If it's less than yas lettuce, you can. Yeah, you can put food in a cold oven. No. But I'm saying the same way. From a halachic, I didn't mean to make a joke. What I meant is that from a halachic viewpoint, under yas lettuce bowl is the equivalent to putting food in a cold oven. That's what I meant. Can you put food in an oven which is less than 110 degrees, which is what we call Yad's lettuce bow? The answer is yes. Under the measure of what our rabbi saw as the ability to cook is the equivalent of cold.
What?
Because putting food, right, those. Yeah, but I guess a cold oven is not the act of putting something in. Putting food in a cold oven is not. It's the equivalent of you want your dishes to dry, you know, a drying rack, you put them in a dishwasher rack. You're not worried that that's going to be like running the dishwasher. I think.
So what happens? It's not allowed.
To what?
It's not allowed then.
Which is not allowed?
The challah in the hot oven.
Challah in the hot oven after Shabbos. Yeah, I think it's not allowed. I think.
Or,
Jessica.
Yeah, what if you were kidding in the morning and you want some awful? It's already all cooked and you want to stick it on the pot. So do you need to put different tin foil? Because usually I put tin foil on the pot.
Yeah,
it's
milk flakes.
Yeah.
Because
that's
marinade. Yeah. It's fully cooked.
If you would have left it in the fridge overnight, they can eat it that way. It doesn't have to
make it all
busy.
Right. You could eat a raw waffle from the freezer. Yeah, so it's like putting a piece of kugel. A waffle is like a piece of kugel. So one piece.
And it's not broken.
It's not broken.
The
sign, we should stop here. Yes.
Can I wash my dishes with silverware? I don't need them for the next day.
If you're not going to use them for the next day, Shulchan Aruch says you shouldn't wash them until after Shabbos. Later, Poskim have come along and say, if it bothers you to have dirty dishes visible on Shabbos, so you're not washing it for after Shabbos, you're washing it for Shabbos.
And then
yeah.
Can you just assume that they didn't know? There's nothing to rely on. They didn't know they couldn't. Put the brisket in the warming room.
Yeah, but even if they didn't know, it could affect you because lemaisa, a malacha, was done on it.
Does the liquid work the same way if you eat it once it's cooler?
So the liquid is complicated.
I've been served soup on Shabbos.
If someone served you soup on Shabbos day and you know that that wasn't a soup that was on since before Shabbos. Right.
The brisket
is
not
anything
before. No, she put it out in the morning. Maybe she was fine.
No, even Sfarim can't do that.
Sfarim
can't do that either. No. Somebody takes a cold, fully cooked soup, puts it on a hot plate on Shabbos morning, and serves it to you for lunch.
Let's say they serve it.
Yeah, you need, I think you need to be allergic to it.
You need to
wash it. I don't know a graceful way. Again, I would want to check this with someone. There is an opinion that ain b'shalach or b'shal even b'dar alach, meaning that there's no cooking after cooking even for a liquid. There is an opinion. So is that minority opinion enough that if somebody even heated soup, you could eat it? I would want to check that with someone with broader
shoulders.
And if you
would eat the saucy chicken out of the sauce, it's still been heated in the sauce, so that's not enough
yeah.
reason not to eat it, or that would make it okay?
No, then you could eat it. In other words, you went to someone's house and they heated the chicken in a sauce,
mm-hmm.
but you take the chicken out of the sauce and eat it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What if you accidentally heated the chicken? Like, you didn't realize that it really emitted more juice than you expected.
What if the cleaning lady did it?
You could serve it, yeah.
Let's say the cleaning lady did it without
us. It's a problem, because a non-Jew doing work that she does for you, even without your asking, you're not allowed to benefit from. We'll get into that when we do our Amir la'akam. But if a non-Jew noticed that you were annoyed in a room that's dark and came in and turned the light on for you, you couldn't benefit from the light being on in that room. If she's going to benefit from it too, then it's okay. Which is why posts can give this very bizarre... Let's say you need a light on in a room. You can't hint and say it's really dark in that room. It's not allowed. Even hinting doesn't work. So what you could do is say, can you get me something from that room? She'll have to go in there to get something from there and turn the light on. And when she goes to the light, I say, oh, by the way, leave the light on. So it's a legal loophole.
Could we say, like, do you want to eat something? Like, you know, somehow it's also...
Yeah, but there, it's less complicated. It's more complicated because she's heating up a little bit for herself. She's really heating up the whole thing for you. Like, she couldn't, if she cooked something for herself on Shabbos day that also had enough for you to benefit from, you shouldn't eat it. Leave out the Bishul Akam issue, but because she's really cooking, that's a real malacha. Alright, so we'll pick up with, maybe we'll finish Bishul, we'll do more areas of Bishul and some Amir al-Akam.